program, if you call or you email, or even if you're looking on the website, that's me. So, you know, I'm kind of the outreach person for our program and the advisory capacity as well. And then we have Abby Silver, who's one of our mitigation specialists with us. So Abby, do you want to do a quick intro?
Yeah, I'm Abby, and I want to say hi to Bobby. I am seeing you for the first time without a face mask. But she and I met last week. I'm a mitigation specialist with the Wildfire Partners program. So I'm one of the people who comes to your home and does the wildfire mitigation assessments. And I've been working for the program since it started in 2014.
And Abby and I share something in that we both work for the program, but we are also mountain residents like you guys. So I live in Netherland, off Ridge Road, and Abby lives in Sunshine Canyon. So we're working on our mitigation too, right, Abby?
I have actually just literally been filling bags with noxious weeds to take to the sort yard
today, right before
this started. In that crazy, crazy orange air that we have going outside.
Yeah, we're going to talk about that in a minute. So we did want to let you know that we record the audio from the event to post on our website, because lots of people let us know that they may not be able to join in, but they love to listen back. They like to hear what we're talking about. So we just wanted to let you know that. I guess we're all getting familiarized with Zoom, but for those of you who maybe aren't as familiar, so just to kind of moderate and not have people talking over each other, if you have a question, at the bottom of your screen, there's a little bubble there that says chat. And so you don't even have to type out your question. You can just type, I have a question, if you are like, hey, I want the floor. And that'll be the signal to us to call on you. So I just wanted to let you know that. And we do have a couple email questions that were sent to us ahead of time. So I might jump in with those if we have a pause during the event. If you're not talking, I wish I could do this, because I have a dog who loves to announce herself to everyone who walks down the road in front of her house. But if you're not talking, you might want to use the mute button, and that's in the lower left-hand corner of your screen. And that way, if you do have barking dogs or other noisy things going on in your house, it won't be disruptive to the event while we're talking. But just remember, you want to unmute when you're ready to ask a question.
Can I call you back in 15 minutes after I finish?
Okay. So the event's scheduled to last 1 hour, so we'll start to wrap things up at 7:55. You are free to come and go as you choose. You will not offend us if you pop out, if you disappear from your screen, or you just sign off altogether. No worries that way. Like, if you even want to work on some things and just listen in, that's fine as well. So Abby and I were talking today, and actually we were talking about this before everybody came on. It's been really smoky this week, hasn't it, Abby?
Yes, I think everybody is nodding. So, yeah, I mean, I'm sure everyone knows there's a large fire by Glenwood Springs that is obviously creating a lot of smoke, and there's another one by Grand Junction, and it's hard to know, like, where exactly the smoke is coming from. But, yeah, I think we got through June and July pretty smoothly in Colorado, but the chickens are coming home to roost or whatever, so.
Yeah.
It's scary dry out there.
It is scary dry. You know, one of the things that I was talking about with my husband, who happens to be a meteorologist, guys, so I get my own personal weather forecast here, and we just haven't had a monsoon season this year at all. You know, normally July and August, you'd get some nice rain, you know, in the afternoon, and we just haven't been getting that. And I don't know about your property, but mine is crunching. Like, as I go outside, I hear lots of crunching going on.
Yeah. Crunchy.
Yeah. And because of that reason, I don't know if everyone's aware of this, but the county has upped the fire ban. This was a few weeks, I think it was 2 or 3 weeks ago, to a level 2 fire ban. And I'm going to ask the question, are you familiar with the differences between different fire bans or what they mean, or anybody have any questions around that? I guess everybody's well-versed. Thoughts from you?
Laura, can you explain them?
Explain them? Sure. Abby, do you want to lead off with what the fireband means?
Yeah, so the fireband is basically a tool that the sheriff's department has to restrict activities that they feel are going to potentially lead to elevated wildfire risk. And this year, sort of when the coronavirus started, they actually implemented a stage one fire ban, mostly just to, as extra precaution to prevent, emergency responders from having to go out for things that could be avoided. And basically, without sort of reading every single thing, but, you're not supposed to have personal fireworks. Your fire burning activities are allowed on public property. I mean, on your private property, but not on public lands, except for like a stove, like a cook stove or something, but no open fires. And smoking needs like cigarettes or else has to either be done inside your home or your vehicle or on like a hardscape surface, but you're not supposed to be smoking on grass. And then there's sort of some rules around having spark arresters on items like chainsaws and mowers and things like that so that you don't accidentally cause a fire. And I'll let you talk about what's different with stage two, but I do want to point out that this Grizzly Creek fire, I don't know if everyone has seen the video. There's this great video that a woman took from a raft on the Colorado River right as the fire started. And it started in the median between the eastbound and westbound lanes of I-70. And, they still don't know exactly what started it. But when I heard that, my first thought was like, oh, somebody flipped a cigarette out the window, or somebody had some part of their car dragging on the ground and it was creating sparks. And it's, in some ways really crazy to imagine that something as small as that is going to start what is now, I don't even know how many, 5,000 acres at this point or something.
So. Yeah. So, and that actually raises a good point that that's why they upped the fire ban, because when it gets really dry, tinder dry like this, then, the smallest thing, like you could have something from your car hit the ground and the sparks that, like if somebody got a flat tire or something, let's just say you blew out your tire and the rim hit the road. Those sparks alone could be enough to start a fire during kind of conditions like that. And so that's why they're being ultra careful. And, in terms of the differences, I think Abby kind of went over them, but one of the big differences, recreational shooting. So there's no recreational shooting allowed on public or private land of any kind right now because of the high fire danger and the level two fire ban. And just, more restrictive in terms of campfires and stuff like that. So anyway,
yeah, I think in stage one, you can have a fire on your own property.
Yeah.
But in stage two, you can't even do that, even if you have your own fire pit or whatever.
Yeah.
So that's one of the bigger differences. I think you can still use like your gas grill, but I think in the stage two, you can't even use a charcoal grill on your own land.
Right. So if somebody has a question, again, you can post it in the chat. You can either list your question there if you want me to read it out loud for everyone, or you can just say, I have a question. But I am going to start with something that was emailed to us, and this has to do with the chipping program. And so hopefully everyone knows that we have a chipping program this year. We're about halfway through, I think, Abby. I think we're about halfway through.
Yeah, a little further. I think we've passed the halfway point.
Yep. So, and this person submitted a question, and they said, I hope my stacks of slash along the road are appropriately stacked. And they wanted to know, what were the rules in terms of putting your slash out for chipping? And so basically, is everyone familiar with our chipping program? Did you all get the emails about that? Oh, somebody is saying no, they're not familiar. Okay. So FYI, and I'm going to put this in the chat, if you don't know about the shipping program, and again, I cannot guarantee that your pickup.
I like the thumbs up.
Okay. Hasn't come and gone. So there's the webpage for that. We got some grant funding through sustainability, and we decided we wanted to offer shipping to everyone who's in Wildfire Partners, which is a great thing. We've heard lots of good comments. So part of the deal with that is you do need to stack your slash accordingly in a certain size pile, you know, along the road. And, so cut ends out is really important to remember. You know, it makes it really hard for the shipping crew if the cut ends aren't facing out, right, Abby?
Right. I mean, that's basically, I mean, we kind of have two main, requirements, or certainly like strongly requested. I mean, obviously we're not there supervising you when you stack your slash, but one of them is to stage it just a few feet off the road, and the second one is to have all the cut ends facing outwards. And that's, you know, sort of for the safety of the crew to have it not, like, super far back in the woods so it's convenient, but also not, like, poking out onto the road so that while you're waiting for the pickup, it's kind of impeding traffic.
And I've had a couple questions in tandem with that, because I've had people asking, like, I've got piles of pine needles and cones. If your needles and cones are attached to a branch, that's fine, but they don't want just big piles of cones and needles, like, sitting by the side of the road. So I just wanted to clarify that. And then the other question I've had in tandem with that is stumps. People are like, well, what do I do with my stumps? This seems to be a big question.
Everyone asks that question.
Everybody asks that. Because
there's nothing good to do with them.
No, there is nothing good. This is my personal philosophy. You just find a really steep hill on your property and roll it down as far as it'll go. So that's my philosophy on the stumps.
But I'll tell you what, Leslie, that's what we did when we built our house, and we had total buyer's remorse afterwards, because now these things are, like, kind of unsightly, and they're way down the hill where they're really hard to get to. So I don't know. Like, you know, we didn't think that went through, although, of course, it is a bit out of sight, out of mind. It's not like we spend days mulling it over.
Right, right.
But honestly, the only thing to do with them is send them to the landfill, and that's not, like, a fantastic option for people either. So
yeah, Western Disposal will take stumps. That's in Boulder, mm-hmm. And they also, I was told by Wayne. In fact, I should probably look this up to make sure I say it right. So Abby, if you can continue the conversation.
Carry the conversation somehow.
Yes, because I want to make sure that I say this right, because I would hate to send somebody to the wrong place to oh, hang on, guys. Abby,
right, there's a very hilarious comment by Leary in the chat, which says the prior owners of our house were really good at dumping stumps off the hill, which, yeah, I hope that whoever buys my house doesn't make that same comment, but they probably will. And Bobby, to answer your question, the chipping program is designed, it's like a 10-week program, and there are 10 neighborhoods, and each one was assigned a week. So some of them are done, and others are still to be done in the next few weeks. So I honestly don't, I know you're up Magnolia, I mean up Sugarloaf, but I can't remember when the week is, so you can follow Leslie's link to the chipping program webpage and put in your address, and and you can see if we're still coming to your neighborhood this year or not. But the last week, I think, is like the second week in September. So
yeah,
we're,
that sounds right.
I think we're sort of I think we're in week 5 of 10. So we're just a little over the halfway point.
Okay, we have a couple questions in the chat or comments, and then I'm going to also let you know what Wayne said exactly, because I want to make sure everybody gets this right. So this is what he said. You can take your stumps to Western Disposal. If you have several trips worth of stumps, you can order a roll-off 30-yard dumpster to come to your property. and you would just want to contact Western Disposal directly about that. Does that make sense? I don't even know what a roll-off is, but I'll just be honest and humble here.
Well, I think just for your edification, and if anyone else doesn't know, it's one of those like giant dumpsters that are, as opposed to the ones that you see in the alleys, which are like maybe, I don't know what they are in terms of size, maybe like a 5-yard dumpster or something, a roll-off is much larger. It's the ones you see at construction sites.
Okay. All right. So that's the latest, greatest, best information we have on stumps. And so I have a few comments here in the chat, Leary, oh, I love this comment. The prior owners of our house were really good at dumping stumps off the hill. We might need to get a hold of those people. So, Ellis, does ends facing out, or Ellis, if you want to, do you want to ask this question, or do people want me to just read it?
You can ask. Yeah, read it.
Go ahead, Ellis. Go ahead.
No, I just didn't know when you said ends facing out, if that meant away from the road or towards the road.
It means towards the road. It's like the first thing you see when you look at the slash is
the
cut end of this.
Okay. Gotcha.
Stick.
Okay. Yeah. That's what I hoped. Okay.
And
thank you.
Evan, you also had a question. Did you want to ask that question or?
Yes, just if you had just a small amount of waste, just a few yard bags worth of waste, is there a centralized place to bring it for the chipping program? Because it doesn't seem worthwhile to have them come by.
Actually, no, we would still like you to stage it and let us pick it up, and I'll explain why. This is grant funded, and the more people we have sign up for the chipping program, the better our chances of continuing the program for next year. So we actually want you to sign up, even if you've got one tree that's like staged by the side of the road, we want you to sign up because it helps us continue the program. Yeah. So yes, thumbs up. There we go.
I love his thumbs up.
Yeah. All right.
Can I sort of interject too?
Yeah.
That, you know, if you miss the chipping program or, this happens outside of that time. I mean, for those who don't know, there are two sort yards in the county. One is in Nederland. One is in, or just north of, the Boulder County line in Larimer County near Allen's Park. And you can bring, all sorts of yard waste, not stumps and not like, construction products and stuff, but all the different types of yard waste can go there. If it's noxious weeds, they need to be bagged in those brown compostable bags. And then the other place that takes yard waste all year round is Western Disposal down in Boulder, and they do charge. And I have a slightly funny story about that. I showed up there one day. I had missed the sort yards and they closed and I didn't make it up there, and I had like 12 bags of yard waste, and I was like, whatever, I guess I'll just pay. And I went down there, and I, you know, they weigh you on their way in, and then I dumped my 12 bags and I weighed on the way out, and I get to the guy and he's like, that's 49. And I was like, $49? Oh my God, I can't believe it was that expensive. And then he's like, 49 cents. So it is not going to break the bank if you have to end up doing that, although it is, of course, like pretty far east in the county. So it's good, but it's good to know just in case you miss the boat on all the other options.
I also had a question from someone, Abby. I think this is a good time to drop this question in, because someone had written us and they said they had some trees that looked like they were dead or dying. Sorry about that, guys. Let me see if I can get rid of those people. And the question was, A, how do they know if it's possibly beetles that have killed the tree? And B, if it is beetles, when is the best time to cut? Because she said she had heard, you know, some direction around that of in terms of if you're cutting down a beetle-infested tree. Abby, do you want to?
I'm happy to, although I know you're sort of a beetle specialist, so I don't know if you wanted to
I like Ringo. Ringo and Paul were my favorite.
Right. All right. Well, I guess I'll take George and, oh my gosh, Paul. I can't believe I almost forgot Paul's name. So yeah, but no, you can tell generally that it's a beetle tree because of the pitch pockets, which are like these kind of gooey mounds of kind of dried pitch that will, they're basically sap that the tree is trying to push the beetles back out the hole that the beetles are boring with. So if you see a bunch of those on a tree, that is a pretty good sign of beetle infestation. Do you know of anything else? I mean, sometimes there's like sawdust if it's a
Yeah, so sometimes you'll see sawdust around the base. So the reason she brought that up is because my former career before this was as a park ranger, and I worked at Rocky Mountain National Park for several years. And one of the programs I did while I was there was actually called Meet the Beetles, because, you know, as if you've been around here a while, you guys know we went through a quite an extended pine beetle epidemic. And so, yeah, sawdust around the base of the tree, as Abby mentioned, but yeah, those pitch tubes, like if you see a lot of sap that's been thrown out from the trunk at various places along the tree, that's a, and the tree is starting to die. I mean, that's sort of a dead giveaway that it's probably, beetles. So in terms of cutting the tree down, Abby, I mean, I can tell you what I, but I, you're the mitigation specialist, so.
Well, why don't you tell what you know and then
add
on if I have
anything to add. So yeah, I'm sure everyone knows this, but the beetles bore into the tree and they nest and they lay eggs and then they hatch and they fly tree to tree, which is another reason to thin out your forest, you know, because if you have a greater number of trees closer together, then you'll probably have a bigger beetle infestation in the trees around your house. But so yeah, they fly tree to tree. So the thinking is if you cut them down fall, winter, you know, after the good hard freezes come in and hopefully kill off, you know, the eggs, then you won't have that flying thing when you cut them, you know, so that's the thinking. At least that's what I've always heard. Any thoughts there?
Yeah, I mean, I know that when we were in sort of the throes of our beetle infestation back in, I guess I'd say like 2010 to 2015 or something, if maybe I'm not quite right on the years, but at that time people were definitely advised not to to cut in the summer because the sap that was released kind of brought about, you know, it sort of encouraged the beetles to come to the trees nearby. So if you cut a tree, then they might infest the healthy tree next to it.
Yep.
But beetles are part of the adapted ecosystem. Sure. And so once that infestation was over, the county's policy at least was that fire mitigation at this point kind of trumps any beetle kill worries that we have. I mean, because it's normal to lose, you know, some trees here and there to beetle kill, but definitely the forest is still, generally speaking, way too thick in the county. So at this point, I think you can pretty much cut 12 months a year.
And then
unless you see signs of something going on your particular property.
And the one thing that I would strongly encourage, I don't, you know, is to get dead trees down before the winter, because we all know what happens in the winter, at least up here in Netherland. I can tell you what happens. Yeah, the wind blows. Here's a funny story for all of you. Another job when I was working as a seasonal park ranger, I worked at Eldora one winter. And we all know that Eldora is famous for getting winds. And so they had this kind of funny thing they said that, you know, when the lifts would shut down, they say, don't say it's wind hole, just say it's like a breeze or something. And so, you know, it was really funny. I had this coworker and she'd say, well, unfortunately, the lift is closed because of a breeze hold. You know, we all thought that was really, really funny, but we know it's much more than a breeze if you live up here. So yeah, it's important to get those dead trees down before those big, you know, downsloping winds come in, because then you're going to end up with wind throw, and you know, you definitely don't want that if it's anywhere that could damage one of your structures, or, and even if it is, you know, it's just better to get it down and take to the sort yard while the sort yard is still open. So a good point there. Okay.
Well, and I mean, I think another consideration that is easy to forget at this time of year is if you are the kind of person who likes to cut your trees down right as close to the ground as possible, once there's snow there, I mean, it makes it really hard to find the bottom of your tree trunk. So,
yeah.
Or it makes a lot of extra work if you have to like excavate it out. And, you know, if it's steep around your property, it can be a little slippery. So, yeah, I mean, I personally like spring and fall just because it's hard to want to be wearing all that clothing and
yes.
personal protective gear, not yeah. for coronavirus, but for, you know, chainsaws in the
yeah,
summer.
Yeah, definitely use your chaps, right? Your chaps,
yeah.
your safety goggles and all of that. Yeah, I'm with you yeah. because I don't, this heat right now is too hot for me. So I prefer doing the heavy work and when it's a nice crisp fall day, you know, that's more my speed. Did anybody have any questions about diseased trees or, you know, options for slash or that kind of thing? I just don't want to keep rambling along here if somebody has a burning desire or burning question they want to answer.
Well, there is a question in the chat from Leary. Oh,
great.
It says, do the sort yards charge to take yard waste?
Leary, what do you mean by yard waste? Why don't you let us know?
Hi, this is Susan. This is Leary's wife. I'm actually the one in charge of the chat.
Okay.
Abby, I think you actually already answered this when you said it was 49 cents for the 12 bags that you brought in. So it's the pine cones and the, you know, weeds and all that type of thing.
Well, and that was Western Disposal, which, you know, the landfill trash hauling people down in Boulder. The sort yards are actually free to Boulder County residents.
Yep, that is your taxpayer money hard at work. So,
yes.
I remember when the sort yards opened, and that was a big, big deal when the sort yards opened. So, you know, that you had a place you could take your stuff and not have to pay anything. So, yeah.
Right.
Was there another question? I'm sorry. I thought somebody else was trying to jump in with another question. Yes, Percy. Go ahead.
Yes, me. Is it okay to cut limbs off healthy trees in the summer, or should I wait till the winter or fall?
Abby?
I think it's fine. And I don't know if you have been doing your own low limbing, and this is one of those projects that Leslie and I talk about getting to. Maybe we'll finally do it this winter, but to put a little guide or a video on how to.
We need a podcast.
Maybe a podcast, yeah. But when you're cutting limbs off the tree, if, like, I'm trying to look at myself, like, I'll do this. If this finger here is the limb and the rest of my fingers are the trunk, you kind of want to cut, like, as close to the trunk as you possibly can, sort of in, like, the C of that branch so that you, but without taking any bark off of the trunk of the tree so that the bark can, like, grow over the wound that you're creating. And that, that will prevent or we'll do as much as possible to prevent, like, a bacterial infection or something like that from getting into the tree. But it shouldn't be a problem.
And then this might be a good time to also mention kind of how much limbs should you take off the tree? How many branches?
All of them. I think you should. No, you want to take you never want to take more than a third of the height of the tree so that the tree has – you know, enough needles to photosynthesize, basically, to live its life. But we recommend going up to, you know, a maximum of 10 feet up the tree trunk. That should be fine. You know, that's the Colorado State's Forest Service standard is 8 to 10 feet. What I personally think is don't don't do anything that makes you feel uncomfortable or unsafe. Like, whatever you can reach standing on the ground and reaching above your head to the level that feels comfortable is probably going to be adequate, unless you're on a super, super steep slope and it's the tree is very close to your house and there's a lot of risk involved. But, you know, for a homeowner, I think that that would be, you know, that would be the good not being the enemy of the perfect in terms of low limbing.
Yeah, we don't want you to, like, try and rig a ladder up and, you know, fall down the ladder and tumble down the hill just because you're trying to get...
Like holding your chainsaw, right?
Yeah, exactly. Well, you know, just because you're trying to get one more branch. I mean, you know, because, the thinking is this, is that most people are around 5 feet or taller, and you can probably get 6 feet off the ground, you know, most people, with pretty safely, you know, without having to, yeah, do other things, so... okay, so we had another question. We've been getting lots of questions about grant funding. So I don't know where people are in their mitigation. Do people feel comfortable kind of sharing with us, like, where you are? Like, did you just get your assessment? You've been certified. Like, where are you in terms of your – or I should ask, is everyone in the program? Maybe there's people that are here that aren't even in the program. We had that last month, so.
So this is Leary and Susan. So Leslie, I've actually been emailing back and forth with you about getting recertified, and somebody's going to be coming out in September. So we got wildfire certified in 2018, and we are due to get recertified. So we're making plans now for that.
That's right. You and I have been going back and forth. Yeah.
Yep.
Kevin just said he's not in the program. Kevin, do you live in Boulder County? Can I ask that? Do you live in Boulder County?
This is me.
Okay.
And I look like I'm virtual, but
I know. I love that background, though. I want to, like, climb into
that. That's my yard, so that's Boulder View. I'm up on Boulder View off of Sugarloaf.
Oh, okay.
We're relatively new to the area, so I didn't really know what the program is.
Okay, great. What? Anybody else want to share, like, where they are or, you know, in the program? Anybody else who's new? Maybe I should ask that question. Bobby. Bobby just had an assessment with you, right, Abby? Do I have this right?
She did.
Okay. And is Bobby, like, building a new home or adding on, or what is she building a new home?
She's building a new home, and she's muted. So if you want to talk, we'd love to hear your voice. But
Well, since Kevin is new, I think this maybe might be a good question to talk about. So I know, and it's really good for you all to know, a lot of wildfire partners, including my entire job, I don't know if Abby knew this, my entire job is grant funded. Like, I would not have a job if we did not have a grant. So, but a lot of our program is funded through a grant through FEMA. And we've actually had a couple of grants through FEMA. And so that is how we're able to give you free assessments. So every homeowner gets one free assessment. So, you know, you don't get multiple ones though, as, I think, was it Susan and Lear? If you get a recertification because it's no longer covered by the grant, we do charge a fee for that. But, so every new homeowner gets a free assessment. And then on top of it, if your property has never been in our program, we're able to offer some financial assistance for forestry work. That's also grant funded. But FEMA has told us that we can only offer that to each property once. So even if the property changes hands, if it's sold, then unfortunately the second homeowner, if the first homeowner, you know, went and did the program, then the second homeowner wouldn't be eligible for those funds, but hopefully their property is well mitigated, right, Abby?
Yes, it should be.
Yeah,
certainly a good ways down the path. And Laurel, I totally see that you have a question, but just super quickly for Kevin, who has not been in the program, and just to give you a quick overview, what we do is someone will come out and do a one-on-one assessment of your property with you, where they will walk around and they'll look for vulnerabilities in your home, any outbuildings that you have, and the landscape itself. And together they'll sort of show you what they're looking at, and then together you will make decisions about what you can do to improve the resiliency of your property. Yeah. And the only other thing I wanted to clarify is that our grants are not need-based in any way. There is no, you don't have to have any sort of minimum or maximum income. It's just money that we were given to spend. And basically, you know, since what you do on your property impacts what happens on your neighbor's property when a wildfire comes through, it's really about creating community resiliency, and that's sort of what the grant is about. And now I'll shut up and let Laurel ask.
Yeah, Laurel, go for Laurel.
We have been whittling down our list for a couple years now, and we have a real stumper in that we have bird holes, pecking holes, way up in a pretty tall peak. One is right at our driveway. Another is like over our septic field, and we can't figure out, you know, ladder scaffolding. Is there some kind of a company that deals with that kind of situation? It's like someone needs a cherry picker to get up to the peak there.
Well, what do you, I'm just curious, Laurel, like the peak of your house, would you estimate it's like 30 feet up, or is that kind of what is the guess? Just a guess.
Let's see.
I have a thought, but.
At least 30 feet.
Okay. Abby, do you, I'm going to let you go first. I'm thinking about something.
I guess I have a question. Are you thinking of dealing with this yourself, or are you looking for someone to hire?
We would love to hire someone, but we don't even know the category of person to be hiring.
So, I mean, this is more your thing, Leslie, but we have a list of home retrofit contractors, which are not people that we can provide any financial assistance for unless... well, we just point blank, I don't think can.
No, but that's actually one of our questions.
But yeah, it's kind of, it's a list of just people who are willing to do sort of handyman style projects.
Okay, yeah, that we'd love to have a list like that.
Yeah, so Laurel, I'm going to give you the link because it's actually on the website, but I can also email it straight to you as well. But yeah, so these are people, just to let people know, because like the other question I had that I was going to bring up was somebody asked about rock and gravel around the house. I don't know if people have already done this yet, but one of the requirements that frequently most people have is a non-combustible barrier around the home. So that's meant to stop ground fire from keeping up, or if there's embers, well, Abby can tell you the reason why, but. But anyway, going back to this, so this home retrofit list is people we've screened. So we know something about them, and so we've screened them, and so we have a list. Like Abby said, unfortunately we don't have funding at this time to pay for home retrofit work, but it does give you a starting point for people to call. While Abby talks about
I can go on with some more ideas on this subject.
Okay. Well, you talk and I'm going to post.
What you kind of, I think, are looking for is somebody with like some tall ladders who's not afraid to use them. And two sort of types of other contractors that come to mind to me are the window washing people and the painting people. Because both of them are going to be on ladders doing stuff on your house. So if you were planning to get either of those types of services, I think it might be, you know, worth kind of vetting those folks and saying, hey, I'm looking for someone who can also, while they're up there, maybe do. But you'll need to be kind of specific about what you want them to do is part of it. You know, you can't just be like, I want you to fix my siding. And we don't need to like go on and on about this if no one else is interested, but I have sort of some tricks that I've learned, and I'll share the one that I think is the funniest with you, because I was at a home where it was very obvious because the guy had a lot of patches on his sighting that he had had a lot of trouble with birds. And I was like, but there was nothing there that was like, there were none of those little silver things. There was no like fake owl. There was, and I was like, how did you deal with your birds? And he's like, I went to the party store. I got like a 3-foot long rubber snake and I tacked it to the eaves of my house. And he said, not only did like the birds leave right away, but like generations later, 5 years down the road, they had never returned. So the word definitely got out that that was like the creepy house with the snakes living in the roof. And so I don't know. I've seen people try it since then, but I think it's worked pretty well for them. But again, you've got to get somebody up on that ladder to like the peak of your eaves. And but if you give them a rubber snake and a nail and a hammer, you know, probably they could put that up. And then it's a conversation starter whenever we start to get to have friends over again, too.
Yeah. I'm glad you told that story because that was the piece I was wondering about. Like, you can fill the holes, but how do you keep the birds from making new holes? So that's that. I like that story. So.
It's very hard from what I hear.
So,
and, you know, I will say this, that I have occasionally had folks who – it was just so egregious and they were just so frustrated that they did end up taking my recommendation and they just re-sided that particular section of their siding and replaced it with like a cementitious siding material that kind of matched the wood, or, you know, like a hardy plank type thing that you can paint to match the rest of the panes on your house.
So then you kill two birds with one stone. Ha ha.
Oh. Make it a pun.
That was bad. Okay. So I just want to make sure nobody else has a question that's with us here, because I'm going to move on to one more email question here. Okay. So the question was, talking about grant funding, is there grant funding for the rock and gravel barrier around the house? So, unfortunately, right now, I'm going to say right now, the answer is no, because we're always looking for grant funding to do other projects, right, Abby? So,
yeah.
So, like, we had chipping this year. We never had chipping before. So, you know, who knows? But I do want to talk about the rock and gravel barrier around the house because, you know, I actually – so if you guys get our newsletter and our – that comes out monthly, that's – kind of me and Abby behind the scenes orchestrating things. But there was a blog post.
It's just Leslie behind the scenes. Thank you for sharing the credit, but I wish I could take any of it, but it's you. You're a wonderful writer.
But we had a blog post, I think it might have been last month, called The First 5 Feet. Because that first 5 feet around your house is super important, right, Abby?
Yeah, absolutely.
Okay. And so what's the rock and gravel have to do with all of that? Why is that so important for mitigation purposes?
Well, it's the last line of defense, obviously. I think, Leslie, you alluded a little earlier to if you had a surface fire, like if you have grass growing right up to your house or close to your house, if you have natural meadows that you want to preserve, whatever it might be, that gravel perimeter will stop a fire that's running through the grass, and it keeps that heat burden that much further away from your home. Whether you have wood siding, which, you know, was very popular in the 1970s in Boulder County. So now that siding is like 50 years old and it's been baking in our Colorado sun and our very non-humid air for, you know, all that time, very combustible. Or the other thing that people have often is those kind of ground level windows where, you know, that are very vulnerable to heat cracking. Mm-hmm. So it is sort of the final line of defense. And I know I'm probably boring Leslie with this story, but I live in the 4 Mile Fire area. And back in 2010, when I was a little more green around the gills with the wildfire mitigation, I had very carefully that Labor Day of the fire weeded my non-combustible border, but just outside of that, the grass was probably a good 4 feet tall or something like
that. Well, we don't want you to do that.
Well, I'm just saying the mistake was made, but even in spite of that mistake, the gravel totally worked, and that it did stop the fire from coming to my house, and my house did not burn, which we are forever grateful for. So.
Yeah, so if you've had an assessment with us or you get one, Kevin, hopefully we, you know, you apply and we get to do an assessment for you. We hope that's the case. It's almost universally a requirement for pretty much, I mean, I don't think I've ever seen a report that was required, unless the person already had it. Yeah, so, and there are different ways to accomplish this. I mean, it's really interesting because we did a photo gallery on our website, and there are some artistic barriers, Abby. Like, there are some people get really creative with these barriers.
Yeah, like different colored rocks or, and the bare minimum, if you live in a place that isn't really prone to like aggressive vegetation, is just bare mineral soil. I mean, our soil is, mostly decomposed granite around here. You know, we're not talking about loamy peat ground or anything like that. So, yeah, and it's easy to maintain with a rake, like Leslie was saying.
Yeah.
And then you can go from there to, like, you know, I've seen people have full-on concrete poured around their whole house.
Yep.
I've seen flagstone.
Flagstone, yeah.
Then you can go to our gallery and see some of these artistic things that people
did. Yeah, somebody did like
multicolored rocks.
I know. That was, it looked like a little mural in the ground or something. It was.
Yeah, that was one of the pictures I took.
I love that one. But you don't have to get crazy. We just offer that up, that if you're like, oh, it's not going to look good, like some people have done some amazing work. I've seen some kind of multicolored brick too. I've seen that as well.
Oh yeah.
So lots of different ways to do it, but yeah, the minimum is the bare mineral soil, and that won't cost you anything except sweat equity and a rake, the cost of a rake. You know, you'll probably have to work at it a little more regularly to keep those weeds out. But the one that is, and that's why this question came up about grant funding, is the one that's most common for most people to use is you rake it out, you lay down weed barrier or weed block, and then you do 3/4 inch gravel over the top. And I'm pretty sure, who's the folks? Is it Pioneer, Abby, that will, oh, somebody's nodding.
Deliver.
Yeah, Deliver, yeah. And then you'll just.
Yeah, around here, I think if you live more in the Allens Park area, there's also like a company out of Estes Park that will deliver.
Right.
To that area. And if you're more in the Lyons area, there's a company in Longmont that, and it's not Pioneer, even though they seem to be all over the state, but I know people have used someone else out in that part.
Yeah. So, you know, you lay down that weed block, you do the 3/4 inch gravel around the house. And if you use good, this is the thing we found out at our house, is there is a difference in quality of weed block. We did two different ones on two different sides of the house, and the one, like, we had no problem, and the other side of the house, the weeds were popping through it. So we're like, oh, okay, so you actually should spend a little more to buy good weed block. And then the other thing I was sharing with somebody today is a leaf blower can be super helpful if you've got the gravel barrier, because then you can just blow the pine needles out. Like, if you get some pine needles that kind of float into your gravel, you can just blow them right out, and you know, you can keep that looking good for a long time, and you'll have that good strong line of defense. So I did want to just give a little time thing here. We've got 10 minutes to go, so I don't want to keep talking if somebody has a couple burning questions that they want to get answered before we adjourn for the evening. I'm just going to throw it open. Does anybody have comments or questions? Oh, everybody's just being good listeners tonight, Abby. Do you have final thoughts that you want to share about anything we've talked about tonight? Fire bans, living trees?
You know, I mean, I guess I really maybe just, smoke is in the air, and I, as you all know now, I'm, you know, sort of a 4-mile fire survivor, so to speak. I mean, And, you know, I think all of us up here in my neighborhood, and Leslie is a survivor of the
Cold Springs
fire too. You kind of have this little PTSD thing when you smell smoke. So, you know, I just urge everyone to be cautious. And, you know, I know we're not really supposed to use water for landscaping here, but if you do have some patches that you feel like you just need to throw a gallon or two or use your gray water on, some of that immediate landscaping right around your house, if it's starting to look crunchier than usual.
Yep.
You know, that might not be a bad move.
We do have a question, Abby. Larry, or is it, I forget, is it Susan? Am I remembering the name right? Who's manning the chat for Larry?
I think you are.
You are, but Larry actually typed that one, so we're kind of tricking you or tag teaming you.
Okay. You have a question about aspens. Go for it.
Yeah, we were hoping to plant some aspens. We think they're kind of neat. We're wondering if there's a minimum distance that you'd recommend to make sure to keep them away from the house if we were to plant them.
Nope.
It's funny because we always tell people if there's one tree that we want people to embrace, you know, it's the aspens, because aspens have a high moisture content. I mean, if you drive through a fire scar, it's really interesting to see like what happens, or if you watch an active fire that goes through an aspen grove, it doesn't have the same effect. Like that crowning running fire that you'll see in conifers, you don't see that with aspen trees. So, you know, aspens are great. And the wonderful thing about aspens is they clone. So if you can get one or two, and they're in a good spot where they're getting plenty of, FYI, as you all know, aspens don't do well in shade. They do need sun. They do need water. So if you can find the optimal spot for them, you'll get a grove going pretty quickly because they'll just propagate and send up little sucker trees. This happened with us. This is something I like to share with people because people get nervous about, oh, I'm cutting the pine trees. And, you know, they get, and, so I had that same anxiety, we did mitigation, and it's wonderful because I cannot tell you how many aspen have grown and are filling in behind our house, like this beautiful aspen grove, because we reduced the competition for them. And so aspens are great, and you can totally have aspen in zone one. Yep.
Ooh, wow. Thank you.
Yeah. Bobby has a question. Oh, Bobby, you're muted. There you go.
You know, I'm muted. I don't think it's a question anybody else would be interested in. It's kind of to the side. So can I ask you?
I will totally stay on with you afterwards. And
okay. But I do want to spin off your question, Bobby, because this actually brings up a question I had from someone who called recently. They have a really long driveway. And they were, you know, saying, hey, you know, we know zone two only goes out to 100 feet around our house, but we have a quarter mile long driveway. And I know, Abby, you have this issue at your house.
I do have a very long driveway.
And there's a reason to mitigate along your driveway, even if it's farther away from your house. And what is that reason, Abby? Please share with us.
Well, there are many reasons. The first one is that you, of course, want to leave your emergency access open for any kind of first responder that you might need to have at your house, whether it's a firefighter or ambulance, police, UPS driver. And I know they're not an emergency responder, but they do drive large trucks, and you don't really want them damaging your trees. So the county has a standard for driveways, which, you know, if your house isn't like historic, I guess it probably has had to meet that. And that is to limb your trees that overhang your driveway at least 13.5 feet. And that should allow for those trucks to drive underneath of it.
But also think about in terms of fire, if there was a wildfire and your driveway has all these conifers that are on fire, that could prevent the fire folks from coming back, you know? So that's the thing I think about in terms of fire mitigation is if you've got all these dense conifers and they catch on fire, then, you know, And it could prevent you from leaving, right, Abby? Like, I mean, what if you're at your house and you're trying to get out?
Right. I mean, so the county for new construction, the standard is basically sort of a shaded fuel break along your driveway, which is essentially the same standard as like zone two on your property. Like you want to have 10 to 30 foot spacing between the edges of the trees out, like, you know, maybe, I mean, ideally 150 feet from your center line if you're super long driveway, but you know, at least sort of the zone one-ish of your driveway should be, you know, like the first 50 feet or so should be thinned and low-limbed as well, so that you do have that egress. And the other thing that I think about on my driveway, because it is, like, as Leslie pointed out, quite lengthy, and it's also sort of steep and curvy, so you can't really see what you're driving up to. And so at this time of year, it's nice to just weed whack like that 2 foot shoulder or whatever it is that you have along your driveway, so that your fire department kind of can see that you're a person who is kind of on top of their mitigation, and if something did happen, they would feel more confident going up the driveway.
And FYI, another reason to get certified is you can get your wildfire partner sign and post it right there at the junction of the road and the driveway, right?
And yeah, and that's sort of serves the same purpose. Like they can see that this is a home that's like keeping up with their mitigation.
Yep. So. Oh, we had one final question. I think we have time to squeeze it in here. Laurel asked about maples. Do we feel the same way about maples as we do as aspen? Is that what your question is, Laurel? Okay.
So I would caution you about planting a maple tree as close to your home as an aspen, and that has more to do with like trees in general. Their root base is essentially about the same diameter as their crown base. So if you think about aspen and the way they grow tall and skinny, they send out more like these runners, like Leslie was alluding to, and they're not very likely to mess with the foundation of your house, but these larger hardwood trees are, they could actually start like impinging on your concrete foundation or like getting down into your septic, or I mean like the pipes that go out to your septic, which when I lived in Boulder was like a twice a year issue for me with my having to get roto-rooted out of my house, roto-rooted all the time. So right. For a maple, I would probably put it like 10 or 15 feet out, but it does still have the same properties as what Leslie was describing, where it is sort of fire shielding. It's a deciduous tree, so it's holding moisture in those leaves until it starts to freeze, and then they just drop off. So...
My personal thing as a park ranger is I always like to see people try and stick with native, you know, things that would normally grow at your elevation. So, you know, there's a lot of people in our program that aspens don't grow where they are, but maybe cottonwoods do, or, you know, some other type of deciduous tree. So, you know, for me personally, I always like to see people, you know, first try to work with what's native to Colorado in their area. Okay.
Short list, though.
We have, yeah, it is. That's true. We have come to the end of our hour, so thank you guys for coming. So we just want to let you know, because I know some of you have come a few times, we're going to keep going through October, and we'll probably take a hiatus during the winter. But, you know, if you do have questions, you know, I'm still going to be here on the other end of the phone. We'll still be answering emails. But, yeah, we're gonna keep doing this for the next couple months. So we'll just send out that information to you by email, and it's great to see you all and keep mitigating, right? And Kevin, I hope I see your application soon. Yeah? Yeah. Give it a thumbs up. Yay. Okay. All right.
Thanks, thank you guys so much for doing this. Thank you.
You're
really
welcome.
Appreciate it.
Totally.
Thanks, everybody.
Good night.
Good night.